Good morning. Petrol bombs, rocks and fireworks were hurled by hooded figures as the police used water cannon to quell rioting on the streets of Belfast. Wednesday night brought scenes of violence many had hoped never to see in Northern Ireland again. Philip Inverclare spoke to BBC reporter Mark Simpson, who was at the Shankill Road.
This was the eighth night in a row in Northern Ireland that there's been violence. And as we know, history tells us that when it comes to violence here, it can become a habit and nobody knows when it's going to stop. And it went up a notch last night. Areas like the Shankill have been quiet in recent days, but last night violence erupted, and it also erupted near a peace line close to the Falls Road. And by 10 o'clock last night, you'd youths from the Shankill and youths from this Falls area throwing stones over the peace line at each other. It harks back to the past, and here we are, 100 years into Northern Ireland, 23 years since the Good Friday Agreement. People thought those sorts of scenes belonged to the past.
And was there any sign of community leaders or adult voices in either community on either side of the peace line telling the youth to go home?
Yes, there was. But no, there wasn't any effective leadership on the ground. And there is this suspicion that the main loyalist organisations here, like the UVF and the UDA, while they may not be making the petrol bombs and orchestrating the violence, they're letting it happen. If you look at the areas where there has been violence in the past 7 days, North Belfast, Newton Abbey, Carrickfergus, Ballymena, the waterside area of Derry, all areas where paramilitaries have an influence, clearly they're not using this influence to stop the violence. They're letting it happen, and I think that's significant.
Also on the line were Claire Hannah of the SDLP and Sammy Wilson of the DUP.
These young people and loyalism and unionism have been told for weeks and months that they're furious, to be angry, that the Britishness is being taken away, that it's the fault of them and that it's the fault of Dublin and the Catholics and the EU. And they've been told this primarily by the DUP, who are trying to cover up the fact that, one, they led us to this terrible point in Brexit by, at every point, taking off the table all of the opportunities for a Brexit that didn't put a border somewhere, and who are now covering their tracks. And he is correct also to say that they haven't been adequately represented. These young people aren't offered hope. Things like educational underachievement aren't being tackled. Things like joblessness aren't being tackled. And indeed, the opportunity to build an economy that works and to maybe try and grasp, make lemonade from the lemons we've been handed, and Brexit is being squandered by the DUP as well. So this is an age-old strategy in Northern Ireland. Make terrible decisions, lead people to a worse place, and then to distract from it, point the finger of blame at other people. Because as I think most rational people know, this isn't the fault of the EU, it isn't the fault of Dublin, it isn't the fault of ordinary nationalists and Catholics, and this is being done to cover the DUP's tracks. But like I say,
let Sammy Wilson back in there on
that.
Claire,
there's an opportunity
just
to reset
let me get something
and try
right,
and
Claire.
Offer these
let
young people some
right.
hope.
Let me get something right. Your party is also in the executive. Your party at one stage held the economy portfolio. Your party makes collective decisions on a day-to-day basis. So if you're saying, and I agree that there are lots of issues which need to be addressed, including youth unemployment, which exists both north and south of the border, educational underachievement, which exists both in the Irish Republic and in Northern Ireland, but if those issues have not been properly addressed, your party is equally responsible for it because you're part of an executive. So don't try and play this game that you're in government but you're not responsible for any of the failures of government. And that's the SDLP play all the time. One of the reasons why the power sharing executive is so hard to work, because parties like yours are inside and yet continually blame the other parties for what doesn't happen.
Final word to Claire Hannah.
Well, I think your listeners will understand why politics is so difficult in Northern Ireland after listening to this interview. All they hear morning, noon and night on the radio is political bickering and blame pointing and finger pointing. There's an opportunity to reset it. There's an opportunity to be honest and open with people about the challenges we face and actually try and solve them, not selling people false dreams that, you know, we'll scrap the protocol, you'll get your Britishness back. Just be open and direct with people about what needs to happen.
Later on the News at One, Northern editor Vincent Kearney spoke to Ian Edwards, who lives on the Shankill Road.
To me, this is happening basically because of the PSNA and the judiciary system's appeasement, the Republicans, and the Popey Story funeral. This has all been kicking off from it. And I also think it's a direct consequence of Boris Johnson saying this is up to the Brexit and the Irish Sea border, that he denied would ever happen. And I think it's a consequence of everything just building up.
Is there real anger within the Lords community?
Yes, definitely. It's palpable. Definitely. Like, I knew what was coming here. I knew this has been building up for ages. And it's like everything. It's like a powder keg, you know. It just needs one thing and it explodes, you know. But this has all been building up. And the DUP are trying to wash their hands of it when, to me, they've been mostly been involved in it, with sitting in government with Sinn Féin and sitting on the policing boards and cozying up to Boris Johnson when he threw them under the bus twice as regards to Brexit. I mean, if we knew this was happening, we wouldn't have voted for Brexit, because to me, all this has done is opened up a constitutional can of worms, because Scotland's looking then to pull out. There could be a border poll here. Wales are looking to pull out. We're left with an Irish border down the sea. We were supposed to get unfettered access to Britain. That's not happening.
How long have you lived here?
About 25, 30 years.
And is this as bad as you've seen things?
This is worse. I think last night was one of the worst I've seen in a long time. Yes, there's always been bother at the peace lines, you know what I mean? But last night was just, it was off the radar, you know? But this is anger that's been building up a long time, you know? And unfortunately, it needs a release valve. And unfortunately, that's what happened last night.
Later on Drive Time, Sarah put this to Gerry Kelly, Sinn Féin MLA for North Belfast and member of the Northern Ireland Policing Board.
I think most people agree that it's a maelstrom of different things that have brought us to this point. It's no one element, but one of the elements does appear to be the Bobby Story funeral, the police reaction to that, the decision not to prosecute members who attended it. I know Sinn Féin members were censured last week by the Assembly for attending that funeral. Members across the political spectrum said Sinn Féin members' apologies did not go far enough. They said that apologising for hurt caused is not the same as saying what they did was wrong. Do you think it would be helpful as part of the move to try and de-escalate tensions for Sinn Féin members who attended that funeral to now say that their decision to attend the funeral was wrong?
It's interesting, Sarah, that you say there's a number of issues involved here, and you know, and then spend a considerable amount of time talking about Bobby Story's funeral. You cannot equate what happened at Bobby Story's funeral, people attending a funeral of their friend, to the violence which has occurred.
No, and I'm not doing that, Gerry, to be quite clear.
Let me finish, because you've made the point, sort of. But I mean, there was no violence after Bobby Story's funeral. It was last June. And if the violence has been put down to that anger, then why has the violence been brought to interfaces? I mean, these are crime gangs using young people to push them forward.
Also on the line, Gordon Lyons of the DUP.
Do you think that decision by the DUP to call on the Chief Constable to resign has triggered events that we're seeing playing out over the last 6 days?
No, I don't think it has.
Has it been a factor at all?
I think if you take that to its logical conclusion, then what you would be saying, Sarah, is that we should not criticise or hold the police to account in any way. And if they feel that we shouldn't be asking for resignations. This is a very important issue in Northern Ireland right now. It is right that we speak out against it. And by the way, this isn't the DUP. The DUP, the Ulster Unionist Party, the Traditional Unionist Voice Party, the Progressive Unionist Party, all parties have said that they've lost confidence in the Chief Constable.
Thursday saw another night of rioting, although not quite as bad. On Morning Ireland, Áine spoke to Sinn Féin President Mary Lou MacDonald.
But we're at a particular point in time, 23 years on from the signing of the Good Friday Agreement, where, you know, the streets look like it's the worst violence that people have seen in a long time. A lot of people who've seen it before are scared of going back. Brexit, the protocol, they're running sores. The Bobby Story funeral, I know it's only part of the story, but it has fed, hasn't it, into unionist fears of alienation. So it's, what was the one of the Northern papers' headlines yesterday, no end in sight.
Well, look, there is no doubt that Brexit has opened up a whole series of dynamics. I suppose one of the abiding ironies of Brexit in relation to the North, aside from the fact that people in the North voted to remain, as you know, is that unionism and leaders of unionism were amongst the most ardent cheerleaders for Brexit, despite being told very clearly from the get-go that Brexit was bad news for Ireland and bad news for the North. And of course,
and Arlene Foster saying even yesterday that Boris Johnson now understands that how big a problem is for unionism. She believes he's willing to listen. Again, you know, with issues like the protocol constantly staying in play, elections next year, a vote in the Assembly in 2024, it's hard to see how any of this gets settled and you get back to just working the peace process when these are going running sores, aren't they?
Well, I respectfully disagree with that. I absolutely accept and have articulated time out of number the fact that Brexit was bad news all round, and that remains the case. The protocol is necessary. There are a set of necessary protections for the island of Ireland. They're not up for renegotiation. But the bottom line here, Áine, is power sharing has to work. The arrangements that we have under the Good Friday Agreement has to work. Politics has to lead from the front. We need to bring the community with us, and that those who would choose to stoke up tensions need to be called out. So that's where I suppose political leadership ultimately comes in.
And politicians from all sides appealed for calm, particularly in light of the death of Prince Philip. However, for many, these tensions had been simmering for years. Yesterday's Drive Time brought us this vox pop from BBC Northern Ireland reporter Helen Jones, who spoke to members of the Loyalist community in Belfast's Shankill Road.
The impatient and pushed to the limit, and it's just blown.
Are you not saddened by this, to see this happening?
Yes, yes, but when you walk round and look round your area, everything's gone. There's no prospects. The kids have no prospects of jobs. Nothing. You walk up and down this road and it's completely empty. And you walk up and down the falls of the Springfield and everything's brand new houses and shopping centres. What have we got? Nothing.
Political editor of the Belfast Telegraph, Suzanne Breen, was listening to those views and gave her reaction to Sarah.
It's very welcome that we're actually hearing these voices in the media, because sometimes there is just a very sanitised narrative. The view comes across that everyone is opposed to the violence on the streets, that everyone's against it. And we really do need, as journalists, to go in there and to poke and to prod and to hear real people's real views. That really reflects widespread feeling in the loyalist community that nationalists are getting everything, that they are the community politically, socially and economically on the rise. Now, if we look at the actual statistics about poverty and about deprivation, they don't reflect that. They're both communities. It isn't good for both communities in working class areas, but there is actually greater poverty and deprivation still in nationalist areas. But really, this week in Belfast, we had two sets of youth stoning each other, throwing petrol bombs at each other with hatred in their hearts, when really they are mirror images of each other. They stood there on the peace line in West Belfast, almost identical in their dress, in their background and in their economic prospects, but yet they saw each other as the enemy. And that's a very sad reality for Northern Ireland as we come to mark the 23rd anniversary of the Good Friday Agreement tomorrow.
And the very real devastation families experienced as a result of this violence was brought home when Philip spoke to Nicola McKee Corner, whose sister Lyra was killed almost 2 years ago when she was observing rioting in the Creggan area of Derry.
And presumably watching what we're all watching now on the news is particularly traumatising for you, because you're thinking to yourself, it's only a matter of time before what happens to Lyra happens to somebody else.
Absolutely. Absolutely it is. It's very, very frightening, the thought that, when people were standing in the Creggan on the 18th of April 2019, no one could have anticipated a gunman coming out and firing up the street towards a group of onlookers. No one could have anticipated that. And in the same way, no one knows that in this violence that is continuing at the moment, that somewhere along the line, a gunman may appear and act in a similar fashion, recklessly and carelessly, and kill another innocent human being. For what? For what? What's the purpose of that? All it does is destroy families and destroy lives. There's no justification for any of it.
Nicola McKee Corner with Philip yesterday. Back in a bit. Welcome back. Now, the COVID. You didn't really think you'd get away without your weekly fix, did you? But we will keep it rapid fire. First up.
Why is Wallis and Futuna on the list today but not France?
Yep. Mandatory hotel quarantine. This kicked off last week, and by the end of this week, the coalition parties were of one voice. Nothing to see here, honest. But on Tuesday, it wasn't quite so harmonious. Fianna Fáil TD Paul McAuliffe accused Fine Gael of being ideologically opposed to extending quarantine. Fine Gael Senator Regina Doherty shot back that it was about protecting jobs in tourism and travel. They went head to head with Cormac on Drive Time.
Well, what did you mean when you said not many kids in my constituency go on holidays in the south of France?
Well, I was asked why Fianna Fáil TDs might have a different perspective than Fine Gael TDs on that. And I said, look, I don't know. I said, I'm not getting calls from people saying that they're on holidays in the south of France and they want to come back to Ireland. And look, Regina pointed out that this was about attacking workers. There are workers in the restaurant sector, in the entertainment sector, in hospitality. None of the restrictions have been put in place to penalise workers in any one sector. I feel particularly sorry for people in aviation because they will have even longer periods of restrictions because of this. It's not to get at any one sector. Mm. It's about having evidence to make your decisions and also then to put in place decisions that control this
virus. You're basically saying, Paul, well-heeled, privileged Fine Gaelers are not heeding public health advice. And you've called this Regina Doherty small-minded. Why?
Thing that I would say is I think it's an awful pity that Paul would try and reduce this debate to something as a petty ideological row between Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil. Last week, the Attorney General questioned the legality of the mandatory hotel quarantine system. We've questioned its legality with regard to Maastricht. The Attorney General questioned the legality of actually charging people. And it's about making sure that, number one, we are safe in a legal position, and number two, that it's actually practicable to increase the number of countries from what it was 23 to 46 overnight.
And then the legality of any changes came into play.
The point here is that NPHET have made a recommendation to government. We have to go back for the confidence of the people of this country. We have to go back with a credible reason why we would or would not abide by that recommendation. And if it's only based on the fact that, and Minister Coveney said this, that there's significant population in those countries, that we have investments from those countries, that we have people abroad in those countries. Of course, they're huge inconveniences, but that's not a solid reason to go back to NPHET and say no.
And that's not what the Minister for Foreign Affairs has said at all, or the Attorney General has said at all. And so you're absolutely right. We have to have credible reasons, and we need to have credibility in standing over and expanding. And you are also right. Maybe we should have known the answer as to whether enforcing people from Austria or anywhere in the EU either contravened or didn't contravene the Maastricht Treaty, but we didn't. And so I think it's right for us to pause now to make sure that we have the answers to those legal questions
pause
as to whether
what?
It is legal.
Hang on a second, Paul. Because I am absolutely flummoxed here. I am talking to a Fianna Fáil TD and a Fine Gael senator, both of whom their parties are in government, and both of whom are saying that you should have done your legal research to see if the rules you bought in government are actually legal.
My goodness, I think it's right for us to pause now
to make sure that we are strong on the legal position, either with charging, with Maastricht, and also that it's practicable to increase the number of countries from 23 to 46.
Mon Dieu, indeed, Cormac. Well, on Wednesday, Philip put this to Dr. Gabriel Scally, President of Epidemiology and Public Health at the Royal Society of Medicine in London.
What view do you take of doing anything other than putting everybody who comes into the country in mandatory quarantine, no matter what country they have come from?
Well, it is the logical, in fact, the only sensible thing to do. I'm amazed that there's a discussion about how, depending on where your passport was issued, you might or might not be a risk in terms of bringing in the virus and bringing in new variants, or that there should be widespread exemptions for people coming from countries with a lot of Irish people living in them or whatever. It's a very peculiar way of dealing with managed isolation. Quarantine is centuries old, and it works. But it only works if you do it properly. You can't have half a quarantine.
And it was a case of scrap what scrap when Minister for Foreign Affairs Simon Coveney spoke to Anya on Thursday's Morning Ireland.
Make no mistake here, the government is at one on the need to respond to our public health experts' advice that we need to keep variants of concern out of Ireland. And the way to do that is to use mandatory hotel quarantine to the fullest extent that we can. It's not a case of, you know, Minister Donnelly in favour of one approach and Minister Coveney being in favour of another. That's not what's going on here. What's going on here is a conversation within government to make sure that the capacity issues and the systems issues that are necessary to dramatically increase capacity within our hotel quarantine system are in place before we announce new countries. And unfortunately, what happened was, you know, there was a leak of a list of countries that happened last week before we were ready and had discussed all those capacity and systems issues that are necessary. And that's why it looks like we're trying to catch up with ourselves here. In truth, we're going through a consultation process that's necessary in legislation before we add more countries to the list.
Minister for Foreign Affairs Simon Coveney. One country on the list, though, is Israel, the country which has led the world's fastest vaccination campaign. Inbar is from Israel and she phoned Jo and was less than impressed by her Cade Mila Falcha.
It's all a bit of a mess.
Okay, tell us what happened yesterday.
Well, I arrived to Dublin from Israel. I'm here for my new job. I'm a healthcare professional working at clinical trials. And I arrived, it was all fine. And then at the immigration officer told me that since I arrived from Israel, I have to quarantine in a hotel. Okay. And I had no idea that I have to do that. So I was a bit in shock. Waited there for a very long time for the police to come, for them to arrange the papers, for me to call my employer and ask for them to pay for the quarantine. And it was just a big mess. But here I am at the hotel.
Okay, so tell us, so you're in the airport, and how do you get to do, what's the next, how does it unfold? How do you get to the hotel?
So the immigration officer called a Garda police officer. He came by, asked me a few questions. It took a long while, but he was very lovely. And then they called the army to get me and take me to the hotel. But I landed, it was around 11:30 in the morning, and I got to the hotel only around 3:30. And it was all a bit of a mess. They didn't have all the answers. I asked, how long do I have to stay in the hotel? How can I, you know, get myself out of there since I have my COVID vaccines, both of them, and a negative PCR test result? So I had so many questions, and no one really could answer any of them.
And have you been told categorically, Inbar, you're going to be there for 2 weeks, even though you've been doubly vaccinated, even though you've done a COVID test? There's no appeal that you can go beyond the one you've already used.
I tried actually to appeal to the state liaison officer here. As soon as I got to the hotel, I filled up an application telling them that it basically makes no sense because I can provide documentation showing and proving that I'm vaccinated, both jabs, and I have a negative PCR test. But they said, well, since Israel is on the list for Category 2, I believe it's called, they cannot let me out of here. And I just think it's absurd. I don't know what to do.
Not a lot to do, I suspect, except sit in. That was Inbar with Joe on Thursday's Liveline. The following day, Philip put this to Environment, Climate, Communications and also Transport Minister Eamon Ryan.
Yesterday, Liveline heard an absolutely Kafkaesque story from an Israeli fully vaccinated woman who came into this country and was required to quarantine mandatorily in a hotel, and even though she could prove that she had been vaccinated. Is this system working properly at all?
Yes, because we're following health advice.
And it will change. This is not something that's fixed. It will change as the likes of the changing circumstances in Israel, their numbers seem to have dropped quite significantly. We will have to continue and adapt in countries like that where the risk is reduced. The requirements for quarantine will change. And this is not going to be a permanent fixture. This cannot be designed as a way that's going to be there forever and a day. We need connectivity. Mm-hmm. We need the ability for people to come home and travel and so on.
But if you are following the most up-to-date health advice, how come people from France and from Italy and Germany aren't being required to quarantine? People from Israel are.
And that is being considered at the moment.
Minister Eamon Ryan. One little bit of good news. Only one COVID case in 1,000 is picked up in outdoor settings. Now, we all knew that the outside was good, but this good? Wow. There was a but. Of course there was. Here's Colm Henry, HSE's Chief Clinical Officer with Gavin on the News at 1.
I look around at people meeting up outside in recent weeks in parks and playgrounds, children playing together in streets up and down the country. Many people are way ahead of the guidelines on meeting outside. Don't these figures suggest that they're right?
Well, as I said, we know transmission of the virus is for the large part associated with indoor, congregated, poorly ventilated settings. That doesn't mean it's exclusively so, and it doesn't account for all the associated activities that happen with all outdoor settings. As I said, with sporting activities, for example, not often the sport per se that leads to transmission. It's the travel to and fro, the socialising that's associated with it. And similarly with schools, we know schools are relatively low risk for transmission, but the activities associated with schooling sometimes have led to outbreaks and sometimes have led to amplification events, as our public health experts call it.
Outside, certainly better, but with caveats. And while we're at it, pull up your mask.
Why don't we say to someone when they pull the mask down, would you just pull it up? Like, why can't we do that? Like, in Germany, or I think any Scandinavian country, they'd say, yeah, no, you must put the mask back on because otherwise you will give us the COVID. Whereas in Ireland, we go, ah, you're grand. Yeah, no, spit it all into my mouth and my eyes. I'd love it. I haven't had COVID for months now, and I must have no antibodies. So, yeah, give us more. But why, you know, what is wrong with us?
Oh, you know he means business when he's tapping that pen. Nose and mouth, people. Nose and mouth. Back in a bit. Welcome back. John O'Regan is the producer behind Reeling in the Years, and he spoke to Ryan on Tuesday. Now, the series is now knee-deep in the noughties, but how exactly do they go about choosing the music to go with so many different news events and memories? Prepare for your brain to melt.
We'd go through lists of footage and we'd work out what we can afford and the license of our copyright. I mean, I can give you an example, the one that sticks in my mind. You know, there at kind of midnight or 1 o'clock, kitchen table, and you've got the computer drives. We're talking about 2012 there, and you're blasting through it and you're looking at all the footage, and I write everything out in A4 hardback copies. I've got about 15, maybe more of them now. Everything I write out longhand because it helps me to work it all out.
Wow.
So in 2012, if you think of 2012, you've got the opening of the Titanic Centre, Belfast, looking at that footage. Would be good to have a Northern Ireland story because we're always doing the troubles. No, look, hang on, there's a Costa Concordia sinking, if you remember that big tanker. And then you're looking at the Loyalist flags because Tommy Gorman's got a really good piece there from Belfast City Council. Do you remember the Loyalist flags protest?
Yeah,
and Richard Haas, oh no, that was 2013. And there's a Sinn Féin councillor saying some Loyalists are behaving like it's 2012, but that's a century ago. Would that connect to the Titanic? Don't know. And so I'm looking at Taylor Swift and this is Somebody I Used to Know. Do you remember Somebody I Used to Know?
Yeah, Taylor Swift.
And then you're thinking, well, Taylor Swift, hang on, We Are Never Getting Back Together. And you've got, oh, look, there's Lance Armstrong admitting to doping. And Ronan's told me Pat McQuaid's Irish guy's in charge. Would that work? And then you look at the Loyalist flag protest. You've got Martin McGuinness shaking hands. You've got, oh, Sean Quinn in the court case.
Oh,
got
my Bertie God, Hearn. My head is melted.
But so what's going to work? And you can see it in a few weeks. Nathan Nugent, the editor, has cut it together. You see, and viewers can decide if it works or not. All those things. Mahon Tribunal, Bertie Hearn. You go talk to your friends, talk to my friends, talk to me. But we are never, ever, ever getting back together, like ever.
Good choice. Now, if you think you've heard the first cuckoo of spring, unlikely, says Niall Hatch.
Every year in the national newspapers, you'll have people writing in saying, I just heard a cuckoo on the 1st of February. Is this a record? I always want to write back and say, no, but it is a mistake because it would be impossible for a cuckoo to be in Ireland and singing at that stage of the year. What it is a collared dove or a wood pigeon.
Right you be. But if you do really think you've heard a cuckoo, do tell Mooney Goes Wild, because they want to track all the cuckoos in the country to help gather data on the declining cuckoo population for Birdwatch Ireland's Spring Alive project. So, to aid you in your task, here's a little bit of compare and contrast.
Do you know what this bird is?
Well, I do know that one, Derek. That's the wood pigeon. It's not a cuckoo.
And our next sound now, Richard, for you.
Well, now you couldn't be mistaken about that. That is the cuckoo.
Derek, Aina and Richard, as heard on Mooney Goes Wild. That's that settled. On Easter Monday, Colm O'Regan wants a word, and he was delving into Hiberno English. And not for the first time, the Yank, bring out the Yank, to blame for us all talking Brooklyn. But maybe what we needed to get our culture on was a good old-fashioned Hiberno English oral exam.
Come in, Tafek.
How's it going?
Ah, the finest. Welcome now to your Irish-English oral. What's the story? Any scandal, huh?
Not too bad. Like, my hobbies are listening to pop music. Fec, je m'appelle... Ah, no, wait. Is if I na druggy on Fibis Mo?
Would you relax the cax, lad? Only having a bit of crack with you.
Oh, right. stop the lights, you scaldy balls, you.
Ah, that's well funny, that.
Feck, she's doing the Ulster dialect. This wasn't supposed to. Okay, improvise. I was Belubas last night and I'm in ribbons.
Right enough, surely. Now, what do you make of this old consent stuff and the whole Me Too thing? Any views on a United Ireland?
Sure, this is it. You know yourself. Pull the devil by the tail. Better than a kick from a donkey, huh? Sure, look, that's the way.
Very good.
Whew. From Colm O'Regan, once a word on Easter Monday. Now for something truly beautiful. Voice of renowned soprano Veronica Dunn, whose death was announced on Monday at the age of 93. On Arena, Fergus Shiela of Irish National Opera and singer Tara Rocht joined Sean to remember the singer and the teacher her friends knew as Ronnie.
You mean the voice is extraordinary when you listen to it there?
Yeah, absolutely. I heard that about 6 months ago on the radio, that Omia Bibino Caro, and it was stopped in my tracks because it's so beautiful. And exquisite in its attention to detail, its attention to vocal production. And what I see Ronnie as is this custodian of a tradition that goes back, you know, really centuries, and it's passed down through people who are absolutely experts. And in Ronnie's case, it was all about the vocal sound, about how you use your vowels, your consonants, how you pronounce your Italian. It's such a cliche, I suppose, that it's all gone with her passing. Mm. But it's a really monumental moment, I think, because you build up a lifetime of experience and work and knowledge. And she did so much to pass that on to so many people.
And one such pupil was Tara Erocht.
I was wondering, is there such a thing as a Veronica Dunn sound? But she seemed to be able to actually get to the person. She wasn't interested in, if you don't have a voice, don't come near me, kind of was in some ways the attitude. But she went right into it to try to get the person's voice, not just some kind of nebulous thing, some objective thing. She wanted to get at the person themselves.
Absolutely. And that was the genius in her teaching. I mean, one of the interesting things is that I didn't really realize the genius of Ronnie until I went abroad. And because of the technique I had, other singers were able to say straight away, oh, you must be a student of Miss Dunn. And I couldn't fathom how they knew that. And everybody would say that she never produced a generic sound, but she would find an individual voice and she'd shape a rock into a diamond, is what everyone would say. But because she had the ability and the tenacity also to take the time and pay attention to each person and get to know each person, that she would get you in a position, I suppose, where you were vulnerable enough and you trusted her enough to really, really depend on what she was saying and go with everything she asked you to do. Because as a young student, when you begin to learn a real technique, I mean, it is an out-of-body kind of strange experience, you know? And so the one thing with her was that maybe you or I wouldn't hear the amazing natural sound in somebody, but she would hear something or see something in their personality and she would know that she could sculpt that person. Mm.
And technically, she favoured the Italianate sound, an open vowel sound, which she achieved by sending people off to buy apples.
Ronnie's big thing was that we actually, as Irish people speaking English, we speak quite actually Italian vowels in general. But every single new student of Ronnie's would be sent to Moore Street to buy 6 apples, right? And she would send you to Moore Street as a kind of a masterclass in perfect ah vowels, because that beautiful ah, how are you, that Dublin ah, was, in her opinion, the most perfect Italian and ah we could ever hear. And I used to love this kind of first week every year because her room would be full of apples. And you think, oh, there's been new people. And she sent them down, especially if you weren't from Dublin. It was gas. It was like a rite of passage. But the main thing was that Ronnie would always say, you know, you cannot manipulate the sound. Your microphone is your face and nobody's face or skeleton really is the same. So her whole thing was trying to find what your natural sound was like and to leave it as unmanipulated as possible.
Tara Erocht and Fergus Shiel joining Sean to remember the late Veronica Dunn. Like family on Easter Monday, saw Brenda checking in with the Hopkins Lennon family from Bettystown, whose triplets are now a year old. But way, way back, at the insistence of big sister Casey, parents Emma and Dave hosted a gender reveal party. Yes, a gender reveal party. 1, 2, 3. Girls, Quinn, Callie and Minnie. But that party was all before the COVID. Now, milestone events are captured on Instagram for family and friends so the triplets' progress can be shared and remembered.
You have such a loving family. You must miss that buzz of them all participating and all the different things you've going on.
People that are in that now, I mightn't have talked to in months. So even just looking back on that, and I can even hear different people in the background and I'm saying I miss them. You know, there's just so much after I've been lost out on. It's really annoying. The Instagram thing, like doing them stories in the mornings, my nanny and my dad being in in lockdown, isolated and everything, with Nanny being so old and my dad being her carer then as well, they were missing out on so much. And I was taking the videos and I wasn't putting them up online, I was sending them to them. But then, you know, when you're going over your gallery or whatever and you see all these, like, I'm like a personal paparazzi, I've got so many photos everywhere, but I'm looking through them and I'm saying, oh, that was lovely. And, you know, I said, go on, I'll put that up. I was real nervous about doing it at the start, but I'm delighted I have it now because we get to share the joy, and it is joy. The babies bring us joy, but it's great to be able to spread it out then as well.
Oh, so cute. From Like Family on Monday. Now, the comb over, making a comeback for 2021? Unlikely, but if you were tempted, Fred Murray spoke to Catherine Thomas with the how-to guide.
You grow the sides to begin with, so you basically just stop cutting your hair. And then my local barber trimmed one side quite short, and then the other side is quite long, the left side. So to get the classic swept over, comb over look, you have to kind of keep one side short and then the other side long. Like, think of Jack Charlton.
Yes.
He had one very long side and then he swept it over to match the other side.
And all of this to raise funds for cancer charities. Because for Fred, a Movember moustache, nah, just not cutting it.
It's quite the statement. So how do you even begin to go about it, start styling it, making it go up?
Basically, to begin with, you say a few prayers.
Right.
And then basically say goodbye to being intimate with any person for years, maybe. I don't know.
So today is pretty windy out, right? So, like, yep. what are you gelling or like, what sticks it to the head?
Chewing gum and blue tack. I found out since I've grown my hair is kind of greasy. So after a few hours of washing it, it's kind of like it sticks down quite easy, actually.
You're really selling yourself to the single markets here, Fred. You are really selling yourself.
You look, when I got the phone here, your phones will be red hot with the girls calling in saying, get this guy, I need to meet him. So,
Fred Murray with Catherine with his comb over for cancer. Paleoanthropologist Ella Al-Shamahi is the author of The Handshake, A Gripping History. And she spoke to Philip. And turns out we're one sniff off feral.
We actually use handshakes to communicate with each other chemically. And this is shocking for most of us, because most of us like to think that as humans, we don't need to communicate with each other chemically, that we're not animals, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But actually, we are animals. We do communicate with each other chemically. There's all these fantastic experiments where they put cotton gauze under people's armpits. They got them to watch films that were happy or sad, and they gave that gauze to a different bunch of people, and they accurately reflected those emotions on their faces. And they were able to show that the handshake, when you actually shake somebody's hands, you actually do transfer chemical signals, not just that.
So hang on, socially, are we creating an opportunity for us to smell somebody when we shake their hand?
Yes, this is it. And this is what's shocking to us, because it's unconscious, clearly. And they actually used hidden cameras and showed that you are more likely, significantly more likely, to put your hand to your face and sniff if you shake hands than if you don't in a greeting.
No.
It's bonkers. Yes. There's all this this is the point. We like to think that we're not animals, but we are just animals. It's just that we're also able to write and, you know, sing and do poetry. But actually there's all the normal communication methods that, you know, you expect the animals in the plains of Africa to use. We still use that stuff. It's just,
sniff our hands after shaking somebody else's hand, however unconsciously.
This is research from the Weizmann Institute in Israel, and it's absolutely it is really fascinating. Chemical signals are just fascinating. Yeah.
There you have it. Well, on that hand sniffing note, that is it for this week's playback. Thank you for listening. I'm not here with you next week. I'm off storming the county, but talk to you in a fortnight.